Have you agreed to be an organ donor? Have you had an organ transplant or know someone who has? Have you ever had to make that decision for a loved one? Do you work in the field? Well, our guest this hour does or did work in the field, a registered nurse and a former transplant coordinator. And we will get a behind-the-scenes look at the donor organ retrieval industry. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is Tracy Groff. She is the author of The Gift of Life, The Reality Behind Donor Organ Retrieval. She joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being with us. How did you tell us how you got involved in donor organ retrieval?
I started out my career as a surgical tech in the operating room where we handed instruments to surgeons. And during the 16 years I did that, I had been a part of probably maybe 6 or 7 organ donor, at that time we called them harvestings. Now we choose to use the word recovery just because it's a little nicer of a word to use. Mm-hmm. So I thought that it was a fascinating process, and I was always very impressed by the transplant coordinators that came from the organ donor program that basically were like the ringleader for the whole process. I was very inquisitive. I always have been very inquisitive. I would ask them a lot of questions, things about the recipients, where the teams were from, what they were coming for. And then as part of the on-call OR staff, I would have to scrub and assist their surgeons in removal of the organs. Ironically, I started back to school, going to nursing school in my early 30s, and part of that process, one of the schools wanted me to write an essay called My Personal Inspiration to Become a Nurse. And I had to think a little bit about that, and I actually came up with the transplant coordinators. I don't know how there could be more of an impressive example of everything that nursing is in that one role. So I wrote an essay about it, and it did actually get a lot of attention at all the schools I applied to. I got into school, I got out of school, and I didn't really see myself doing that job. Maybe at some point in the future, but I certainly didn't see myself doing it a year out of nursing school. And I worked in psych for a little while because I thought that's the path I wanted to go. And I found myself looking to do something else, and I wasn't really sure what to do, and I found an ad in the paper for a transplant coordinator, and I thought, I don't know. I don't know that I have enough experience as an RN to do that yet, but I decided to send my resume, and I attached the essay with it, and that got immediate attention there as well. So they hired me. They knew that I had not worked in the ICU setting as a nurse, but felt that with my background in the OR and my psych background that they could certainly train me to do that job, and they did.
Yeah.
So
why did you decide to write this? It's a memoir, but it gives us a lot of behind the scenes information of this medical field.
Well, I was I don't know that I realized how unique it is until I stepped out of it. When I stopped doing that job and I started, I went to home, to do home health care, and that's what I do now. And it's different nursing than I've ever done because it's total one-on-one patient, and I love that. But in that process, I started to learn in meeting even recipients who were my patients in home health that nobody really knew how this system works. Nobody really understood how it worked.
Does it work the same way in every state, or are there different systems?
It works pretty much the same way all across the country. Each donor program has some nuances that are, you know, individual to them. Usually it's in the way that they use their coordinators versus how they actually do the process. So some donor programs will split their coordinators up where they have people who are good at consent and those people do only consent. You know, there are people who have strong ICU background, those people do only donor management. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who have strong OR backgrounds who only go to the OR with the donor. And myself, and I know some of my fellow coordinators that worked with me, all felt that that probably is a much better way of doing things if you really want to hold on to the staff that you have, because it definitely would reduce the burnout versus the way the program where I worked, where they wanted you and required that you be able to do any part of the process.
Let's get into some of the nuts and bolts here of your job as the transplant coordinator. Was it your job to talk to a spouse or a family member about the potential donation of organs of somebody who was terminally ill?
Yes.
Yeah, and how did you go about doing that?
Well, the way that the process normally would work is that the hospitals that are in the donor program's region, which each donor program has a group of federally designated hospitals that they are responsible for. So where I worked, there was over 150 hospitals in our region. And donors can be in any hospital with, you know, any hospital has an ICU and an operating room. Basically, a donor could be there. Some of the hospitals, you know, nowadays they'll transport patients to trauma centers and things. So you would definitely spend more of your time in the trauma centers and transplant centers and things like that. But they call all the hospitals call the donor programs with impending death on a regular basis, 24 hours, 7 days a week. And that information is then given to a transplant coordinator who is covering the phones, which was something we all had to do every couple weeks. And you call the hospital, get the information about, you know, the age, the sex, the patient's name, what brought them in to the hospital. Was it, you know, a stroke, an accident, what's happening? Obviously, what kind of stability do they have? Are they, you know, requiring a lot of medications? Do they have any reflexes? We would ask a lot of questions. And then another coordinator who's on call would be dispatched to go out. That coordinator would go out, and she would go to the ICU, and she would meet the attending physician who's responsible for the patient, and she would speak to the staff. Many times the staff knows the coordinator is there before the family knows. Mm-hmm. And that's a common thing, and I know people sometimes get upset about that, but you know, while we're there gathering information, there's a huge amount of respect for keeping that space between what we're there to do and what the healthcare team is still doing, which is trying to save the patient.
Yeah. The healthcare team, let's say, though, has determined a patient is perhaps brain dead but is on some sort of life support because of a traumatic head injury, for example, and from an accident. Then, I mean, what is it? Is it your job as the coordinator then to talk to the family about possible donation, or is that something the other medical team does?
No, we discourage the hospital healthcare team from talking to the families about donation because some families, you know, can perceive that as a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. It's very hard when you're in that situation to have total 100% trust in your healthcare team that they're going to save your loved one if 10 minutes later they're in talking to you about donating their organs. Mm-hmm. So while some doctors and residents and things like to bring it up, part of the whole process and in a perfect situation, we would already be on site. We would already know what was happening with the patient. We would probably already have sent off blood work. testing for communicable diseases, and we would be having conversations with that physician and resident group before they meet with that family. You know, basically saying, I want to know what you're going to say. I might give you a couple suggestions, and here's some ways that maybe you can open up the door to let me come in and talk without really saying who I am. A lot of the teams became comfortable.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but you said without knowing who I am, why wouldn't they want to know who you were?
Well, here's the, and I know as soon as I said that, I thought, oops. What I mean by that is that you don't want somebody walking you into a room full of grieving family members saying, here's Tracy, she's from the organ donor program.
Mm-hmm.
It's not appropriate at that point yet to bring that up. So what the hospitals, a lot of them were very comfortable with introducing us as someone that the healthcare team partners with in situations like this.
Mm-hmm.
So that would allow me to come in and talk to the family, and then I'm the one that tells them where I'm from and why I'm there.
Let's say the patient did not make his or her wishes known, and you have so it is then up to the family, or is it even up to the family even if the patient has the sticker on his driver's license, for example?
Well, a couple things that I think a lot of people don't realize is that we evaluate whether it's on your license or not.
Mm-hmm.
So the hospitals don't call us and say, this patient has it on their license. They call us with impending death, and then we take it from there. So the organ donor programs are actually able to access the DMV, and they know, and they let the coordinator know before she goes to the hospital, whether it's actually on the patient's license or not. If it is on the license, then that is first-person consent, and that legally holds more weight than any other kind of consent you can get. If it's not on the license, we will still be part of the process, evaluating and seeing, you know, watching what's going on, communicating with the healthcare team. And if the patient progresses, the same thing is going to happen, and we're going to end up talking to that family. Because we believed that everyone deserves the opportunity to make that decision for themselves.
Yeah.
And if the patient has already made that decision on their license, then we were trained that it's a different conversation and it's a different form. Literally, it's a disclosure form versus a consent form. And, you know, legally speaking, to present somebody with a disclosure form is a much different conversation than presenting them with a consent form. So if it's on the license, the disclosure forms usually read that, you know, such and such, the patient's name, has given the gift of the following items. And then the form basically just explains to the family how that process is going to unfold.
We need to take a short pause and remind listeners that we are talking with Tracy Groff. She's a registered nurse, a former transplant coordinator. She is the author of The Gift of Life, The Reality Behind Donor Organ Retrieval. Tracy has worked in different areas of medicine, such as the operating room, psychiatric emergency room, and now she is a home health care case manager. Welcoming your questions for her, your experiences with organ donation or organ transplants, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Tracy Groff, author of The Gift of Life, The Reality Behind Donor Organ Retrieval. And Tracy, let me make sure I have the name of your book right. We have maybe it's a galley that has The Reality Behind Donor Organ Retrieval, but I also see Behind the Scenes.
Yeah, I don't know where the behind the scenes is coming from, but it does say, because I'm looking at the cover, it says The Gift of Life, The Reality Behind Organ Donor Retrieval.
All right. I just wanted to make sure. Sometimes, a galley comes out and then mm-hmm. then it's changed for some reason. So, all right. Well, what is it that you want? What is it you want listeners to know about the reality of donor organ retrieval?
Well, one thing I want to clarify that we were talking about before the break, and that is that you had asked me about it being on the patient's license and what if the family is not in approval of that, because that does happen. I mean, it does sometimes happen where you find yourself in front of a family who the patient chose to have it on their license, and the family, for some reason, does not want you to move forward. It's a difficult situation to be in. We do a lot of work to explain to the family, what it means. We try to do a lot of exploring about why they would be opposed to it. Why did they think that their loved one put it on their license? What could have been going through their mind when they chose to do that? But honestly, sometimes they still say no.
Yeah.
And, a lot of people will ask, well, if it's on your license and the family says no, what happens? And most donor programs, including the one I worked for, they have no intention to hurt or, make the situation worse, hurt a family in that way. They would not move forward. Legally, they are allowed to move forward. But most of them will not do it. In a situation like that, because it's just too painful for the family. If they're not able to support the process, it wouldn't be worth it.
Yeah, so you're not going to go ahead
No, we're not going to come in.
Retrieve the organs
if
the family objects.
Right.
Yeah. So what about if... And this happens probably more often than the actual sticker on the driver's license. Somebody doesn't make that decision ahead of time, and it's not really known what that person's wishes are. And let's say, in fact, sometimes I know personally of somebody who was a minor who was
right.
killed in a car accident. Parents, then it would be up to the parents.
Right.
What if there's a dispute? How does the transplant coordinator deal with mom saying yes and dad saying no?
It's a horrible situation to be in. I mean, it's heartbreaking. Your heart breaks for the parents as well,
mm-hmm.
and. I know that one thing all the people that I worked with felt, and that is that none of us are judgmental in any way, because none of us, although we know what the right thing to do is, if it was, God forbid, one of our children, none of us really can say to you that we would definitely, without a doubt, be able to do it.
Are you telling the parents, so no matter what, are you trying to give them the reasons why they should consider a donation and telling them that they are indeed giving a gift of life?
Yes, absolutely. We focus a lot on the recipient side when we're speaking with the families. And that's part of why we were trained in something they called dual advocacy, because we truly believed that we were an advocate for both the donor family and the recipient, and that we are giving something to both parties, not taking something away from anyone. And, in a situation with parents and with family conflict, the best thing that we can do is to get people talking. And, I give credit to my coworkers, former, current, that is the hardest situation to be in, is to try to get all of those grieving people to open up and talk. And, if a mother, many times in those discussions, will find some things out that frankly, no one else would talk to them about but us. Things like how far will, we've had patients, for instance, I know that there was a teenager at one point who the mother was opposed, and as the coordinator continued to work with her, she found out that her opposition was really that they wanted to bury her in her prom dress. and that one of the incisions in her chest would show. And I know some people would say, oh, it's hard to believe that they would not do it for something like that, but that's what was important to them at that time. And the coordinator's job was to try to find a way to enable that patient to give the gift and still honor the mother's wishes. And we were able to do that. Just in talking to the surgeons, there was a different incision approach they could use, and not something they like to do all the time because it certainly makes things more difficult on the surgeons. But in that situation, they were more than willing to do it.
Tracy, let me hold you there because we have lots of callers, and Warren in Appleton is actually an organ recipient.
Great.
Warren, good morning. Tell us what happened.
Good morning.
Well,
I had a liver transplant on April 9th.
Great.
I had liver disease called PSC, primary sclerosing cholangitis, and for 4 years I was diagnosed, and I was one very, very sick man for a long time.
Yes.
And a year ago, this time, right about now, is when I was so sick, and March 24th last year, they took me from Appleton, Wisconsin, down to University of Wisconsin-Madison Hospital, and I got a liver transplant that saved my life. And when I heard the program this morning, I'm all about transplant. I've worked with my coordinators all the time, and they are one of the most vital people in regards to the whole program. And I appreciate what they do, but my encouragement to anybody who is thinking about it, I mean, I wouldn't be here today.
No, you wouldn't. Warren, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Have you written your donor family?
Yes. I was just talking about that with my wife again because we're coming on our one-year anniversary. We wrote them, but the way the system works is we have to go through the hospital.
Right.
And they will go ahead and contact the donor, get them the letter.
Right.
And so we're really wanting to, and it's up to them to contact the university to say that, yes, we will accept correspondence with the recipient because I want to do something special at our anniversary. And for me, it was a gift of life. And for them, I understand that this is not a joyous time, that they're celebrating the death of a family member and wanting to be sensitive to that, too. But if they could receive some kind of joy, some kind of peace and happiness from the fact that I'm alive today and I'm indebted to them. And I'm indebted to my doctors. I'm indebted to my God. I'm indebted to everybody. So many people that I wasn't occupying a cemetery this morning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Warren, I'm so glad you called in, and I hope the donor family will. So it's up to the donor family to decide whether they want to contact you.
Warren, don't try not to feel bad if they don't write back.
Right.
Some families really are able to grasp the fact that their loved one is living on in another person. And they find a lot of comfort in that. Some are not. Some, the loss is still the loss. And
right.
Even though they know that it saved someone else's life, it's still their loss. So I will tell you that I had a patient when I was working that I became quite connected with his father. It was a young donor. He was 21, and his father was somebody who I always thought would definitely correspond with the recipients. He just was that type of person. I really thought that he would, and I saw him at a donor ceremony about a year and a half after the procedure, after the donor recovery, and he still had not written the recipients. And I talked to him about it, and we talked about, you know, why, and I think that he was still trying to come to terms with the death of his son, and he did seem, after the most donor programs have a ceremony for the donor families for the previous year, and they do these beautiful ceremonies where they do music and beautiful video pictures, and they have a quilt, and families are encouraged to make a quilt square that are displayed all over the country about their loved one. And he came, and he proudly took up the square that they had made for his son and pinned it on the quilt, and he cried through the whole ceremony. And then afterwards, he said to me, I think I'm ready to write to them now.
Yeah.
And that was over a year and a half.
Yeah.
But, you know, they have to come to, but I would never discourage you. I would always tell you to keep writing.
Right.
Because even if they are not writing back, Warren, they are reading your letter.
Right, yeah. Right.
And they know how thankful you are for what they did.
Yeah, and I am. So I there isn't a day that goes by when you face death, a traumatic experience like this, there isn't a day that goes by. Multiple times a day, I reflect back on where I am today because of the program, the donor. I can't say enough. I am getting in a process right now of getting on the University of Wisconsin donor program for speaking, for manning tables. It is a program that it is outstanding. And you're right. We're going to keep after it. And I certainly respect. They're going through things that I have not gone through, but I want to honor them so badly with flowers, a fruit basket, you know, something. I just want to honor them because like I said, I'm here today. I'm alive, mm-hmm. and I'm enjoying life, and I'm doing so well. And
so happy, Warren, that you've called. Do you consider April 9th a birthday of sorts?
Or? Oh, it's my new birthday.
Yeah.
I was just telling my wife, I said, I'm trying to figure out what we're going to do on April 9th to celebrate, because this is not just a birthday cake. This is something a whole lot bigger and a whole lot better than, because I don't remember my first birthday, but I certainly remember this one.
Oh, wonderful. And let me leave you. You probably know from your doctors already, but my brother also had one of my brothers had a liver transplant 25 years ago, and he's still with
Wow.
us and doing well. So, you really were given a new life there.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Warren.
Thank
and
you
I wish
calling.
You the very, very best. And I look forward to maybe having you on as a guest on the program sometime. Sounds like
I would absolutely love that.
That'd
be great.
Okay.
Yeah, sounds
great.
Good. Thank you so much. Truly,
thank you.
That might be something we can do from the recipient's point of view.
Sure.
But you know, I did want to talk to you a little bit about that. I mean, times have changed since 25 years ago. I know that in the book you also were very concerned about. At least in the materials that I saw, the sort of warning people about acetaminophen and their livers, because it's dangerous stuff.
It's very dangerous stuff, and I think that I come from the generation that we took Tylenol. We took Tylenol for everything. You took Tylenol for a pain. You took Tylenol for a fever. You gave your kids Tylenol, you know, and we never thought anything about it. But during the few years I worked there, I saw quite a few patients who became donors. Or they started out, some of them started out as a waiting recipient and within a couple days transferred, crossed over into the donor side because their liver enzymes will go so high that it will cause brain death. And there's not a whole lot you can do to get those levels down, especially ammonia, once that starts to climb. But people don't realize, and, you know, the society we live in, very honestly, abuses pain medications unbelievably. And you take a couple Percocet, you know, people take Percocet all the time. And here, you know, I had a girl that I talk about in the book that popped a couple Excedrin for a headache. And that was it.
She went into liver failure.
Yeah, and I mean, and you know, we talk in the medical field. We talk about these, you know, toxic levels and how much you should take within 24 hours, and things not to exceed that amount. But you know, from what I've seen, those people weren't taking toxic levels.
Yeah, I know that the medical field is warning that, especially since there can be that acetaminophen in your, you know, this pain reliever and this other cold medicine and something else, and it's a cumulative effect in some cases too.
Right.
So, yeah, certainly be watchful of that. Dawn in Wauwatosa is with us now. Hi, Dawn. What is your question?
Good morning. I'm wondering why this is not a violation of HIPAA when a hospital discloses a donor's medical condition. Can your guest speak to on what authority medical conditions can be disclosed?
Most of the donor programs are what are called HIPAA exempt, which means that the hospitals are allowed to give us that information without the patient's consent. Now, of course, the donor programs are under huge amounts of confidentiality laws and things and go to great lengths. Once a patient is put into the donor system, even if it's just to send off blood work, they're assigned a number, and all correspondence is done with that number at that point. So it's in some ways, an anonymous system within our own system. I don't know if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're
so,
welcome.
Does it bother you, Dawn, that it works this way?
It does, because we expect that medical records are private, but we're not told that in certain circumstances there is an exemption, and I mean, it doesn't even request permission of the patient. Yes, that does bother me.
I mean, I can see why it would bother you. I guess it's just because I've worked in that field that I understand that it is very private and very, very professional, and we have relationships with the hospitals that are in our region. And if the system didn't work that way, very honestly, there would be no transplant. There would be no donors, because they can't consult you when you're critically ill and say, hey, we want to call in the donor program. We need to give them the information about you. I mean, it's not a situation where that's even feasible. I mean, if they went to your family at that point and said, hey, we want to call in the donor program, you know, the healthcare team is concentrating on saving your life, and that's what we want them to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of people actually are concerned that if they say they are going to be a donor, that maybe the plug is going to be pulled too soon.
Yes, I know. And we hear people express those concerns all the time. And, you know, that's an unfortunate myth, very honestly, because the efforts that I have seen trauma teams go to save someone's life are unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable. And anyone who works in trauma or any kind of critical care setting will agree with me that the last thing they are concerned about is whether you're going to be a suitable donor. That healthcare team is concerned, and their main focus is saving your life at all costs.
Yeah, but even hospital staff, you mentioned in the book, viewed you or, you know, others who are transplant coordinators as organ vultures.
Sometimes, yes.
Why was that? And
because sometimes those staff members basically felt like we were there too soon. Once in a while, we would encounter staff who felt that we were there too soon. We were there too early. They were still focusing on trying to save the patient, and they felt like it was a conflict of interest for them, for us to be there on the unit. And, you know, that's fair. I mean, respected that some of them felt that way.
What did you had a response to some who said
that? Well, I thought my publisher has has used that quote over and over, and I didn't really think it would get used like that. But it was true that, I mean, I did encounter a nurse one night who really gave me a hard time. And, you know, I did say to her, listen, honestly, if your kid needed a transplant, wouldn't you want to know that somebody was out there working as hard as they could ethically to get it?
Yeah, and you stress the word ethically.
Ethically, right, because I'm not crossing any lines of ethicism when I'm doing what I'm doing. You know, but it was a necessary part of the process, because realize when you realize that organ donors, only 2% of all deaths everywhere, only 2% of those can even be a suitable donor. So when you take that 2% and you throw in all the things that can go wrong, because, you know, they're not stable patients, they're critically ill patients, they're trauma patients, and then you throw in people who say no or don't understand, or you're in a hospital that isn't capable of handling a situation like this, you know, where you're talking about brain death exams, and there's so many things that can go wrong, that number even gets smaller. So in order for there to even be the transplants that there are, the donor programs almost have to function the way they do.
We are talking with Tracy Groff. She is a registered nurse, a former transplant coordinator. She is the author of The Gift of Life, The Reality Behind Donor Organ Retrieval. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking about the gift of life, organ donation, and donor organ retrieval. Our guest is a registered nurse, Tracy Groff, who was a transplant coordinator, and the author of the book, The Gift of Life. We have lots of callers who've been waiting, so let's get to as many callers as possible. John in Boaz. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm glad about Warren's story and survival, you know.
Yeah.
And, my brother-in-law had his head slapped on the front of the dashboard in a T-bone car accident.
I'm sorry.
And thank you. But we were in the Hope Room, you know, the whole family, and we're waiting to hear the results, and the doctors come in and said, well, he's got brain death. And the next thing he did, as they said, we want his organs. Because he was a teenager, healthy young man, and it was like a double whammy for us. Thank you.
John, before you go, so they said he's brain dead, we want his organs. Was it that blunt?
Yes. Yeah, three doctors come in. Three doctors, not just one nurse. Three doctors came in to our Hope Room.
I'm so sorry for your loss, and I'm sorry that, how long ago was this, John?
Oh, he died in the late 70s.
I'm wondering if it's still that way. I assume it's not, Tracy.
No, it's not. Yeah. It's not. Unfortunately, you know, I think they were probably so eager at that point and so desperate for organs that unfortunately it made them not make such a good decision in talking to your family that way. That's not the way it's meant to be. I'm very sorry that happened to you that way.
Yeah, I mean,
because
too.
I will tell you, John, that many times coordinators prided themselves on helping that family find some kind of acceptance as to what's happened, find some kind of closure. So we played a big part in that with families and would go to great lengths to help people find that closure. And, you know, unfortunately, it was a long time ago, and I can tell you for sure that the programs do not work that way now. They do not work that way now.
Let's go to Jimmy in Milwaukee next. Hello, Jimmy.
Yes, hi. My mother was 64 12 years ago, and she had a freak accident. She went in a coma immediately. She was in a coma for 7 days, and then during the 7 days, she was on life support the whole time, and then the doctors declared her brain dead after 7 days, and we pulled the plug, and she passed away. Now, when she was alive, she always told us constantly that she's an organ donor, and she will not be in peace unless we donated her organs. We never knew why she kept talking about it the whole time until it was time to make the decision. And we realized at the time that had she not talked to us many, many times about it, we would not have donated her organs. And so we ended up taking the decision that in order for her to rest in peace, we should donate her organs, and we did. Unfortunately, the damage from the accident was so severe that they could only use her corneas.
Oh. Well, you know, corneas are a beautiful gift.
Yeah, it's still a very beautiful
corneas gift. Corneas are a beautiful gift. Never underestimate them, because I will tell you that whoever got your mother's corneas, they went into the OR blind, and they came out and could see. And it is that dramatic.
Yeah. Well, I'm so sorry for the loss that she went through. But when you say, your mother didn't say that, you just wouldn't have thought about it, Jimmy, that would not be something you would have done on your own?
Had she said it once or twice, you know, we probably would not have donated her organs, because, you know, knowing that the doctors would have to cut her up and remove her organs is
right.
So disturbing, you know, that fact. But we knew that this is what she wanted.
Right.
And we knew that she would be in peace.
Yeah.
So we did.
Yeah. It's wonderful that you were able to honor your mother's wishes that way.
It was.
It really is. You give yourself a lot of credit for that. Not everybody can do it.
Yeah, thank you. And all of my siblings and I, you know, we decided that we are going to be organ donors. And now I keep telling my wife the same thing that my mom used to tell us, that, you know, I am an organ donor, so make sure that you donate my organs if something happens to me.
It's very important.
And I just want to comment on, I just want to make a comment to the gentleman that called, I think his name is John, if I'm not mistaken. He had his liver transplant back in April.
That was Warren.
Warren. Mm-hmm.
And that Warren, he was saying that he's going to ride the family.
Mm-hmm.
12 years has gone now since, you know, mom passed away, and we are still not able to correspond with the recipient.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard, so I hope he does not take it personally if they did not correspond.
Right.
It's hard. It's not personal.
That's what I tried to tell him.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, thank you for explaining that, Jimmy. And you did a wonderful job.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Tracy, I guess lots of important messages from Jimmy's call, but I think the one that I took away from that was, if you want to be an organ donor, to tell your family, tell your friends.
Absolutely.
Don't just put it on your license.
It's actually more important. In our opinion, it was more important to discuss your wishes with your family than to just have it on your license and have us suddenly show up and surprise them.
Yeah.
It was much better that the family knew. And, of course, nobody wants to talk about if that's going to happen or when that happens. But it is, you know, it can be a pretty simple conversation and basically a pretty simple statement that this is how I believe, and I believe strongly about it. And I know it will be hard for you, which is why I've already made the decision for you.
Here's Ingrid on Facebook writes that she thinks there ought to be a preference given in receiving organs to people willing to donate organs. Children, she says, of course, should be excluded. Talk some about that, or you know, who gets organs and who doesn't.
Well, I think I do understand a little bit of what she means, and I can give an example, because I don't want to say that it does work that way, but in some ways it does work a little bit that way. So for instance, because there are a lot of living donors nowadays out there for kidneys, many times what happens is if you donate a kidney to someone, and then if at some point in your lifetime something happens to your one kidney, you are moved to the top of the transplant list.
Oh, yeah.
So you are given some preference for organs because of that.
But that's somebody who's actually donated already. But if I'm not an organ donor on my license, should I go to the bottom of the list as compared to somebody who is
an organ? No. It has nothing to do with what's on your license. It has nothing to do with that. That the United Network of Organ Sharing is the organization that controls the lists, and there is no manipulating those lists based on who does and who doesn't have it on their license, or who is willing and not willing to give. I do believe that I heard at one time there are some other countries in the world that actually are starting that. That if it is on your license, you are placed on a different portion of the list where you're more likely to be transplanted, but I don't see that ever happening in this country.
Dolores in Kenosha is with us, and go ahead, Dolores, you're on the air.
I'd like to go back to the last man who called.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like one of the things that scares people is they imagine all kinds of stuff happening back in surgery.
Right.
I'm a night supervisor.
Right.
We had the team come in one night and happened to have a couple student nurses who said, ask them if we could go back and watch. And very generously they said, yes, you can come back and observe. And these young kids, they like codes and that. I like boring. But they went back, they came back, and they said, they explained everything to us, what they were doing. And the one thing that just struck everyone was they said they treated this patient so reverently.
Yes.
They were just
so much for calling and saying that.
Yes.
Because we did treat the donor with an unbelievable amount of respect. Absolutely.
Very much. And everybody at my house is sign the license, and we're all straight on it.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Thank you so much
for calling and saying that.
Well, what is... I wish we had more time. We have a lot of callers who still want to get on, but we have less than a minute to go.
Okay.
Tracy, what is the takeaway you'd like listeners to take away from this program, from your book?
I guess that there isn't any need to be afraid of the process. Most of the time, if you are approached by a coordinator in that situation, they're more than willing to discuss your fears, your concerns, myths that you may believe. It's all about giving something to the donor family, giving them something that comes out of a tragedy. And, that's a gift in and of itself. When you give that to a family, because technically, their loved one has died and they're going to leave the hospital that day with their loved one having died. So they can either leave like that, or they can leave and have their loved one have died and given life. Mm-hmm. And it's all up to them.
Thank you so much for being with us. Tracy Graf is an RN and a former transplant coordinator. She is author of The Gift of Life, The Reality Behind Donor Organ Retrieval. Thanks to Robin Cherry for producing and directing the program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.